Good afternoon, everyone. Today is June 9th, and this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. And I apologize for keeping people holding. The floor has just adjourned. We are here today for two public hearings, and I'm going to start with Senate Bill 786 relating to investigatory staff of BOLI, the Pay Equity and Gender Discrimination. Do you have some information for us? Where are we at? I don't have a sign-up sheet. I think we're getting that as we speak.
Eric's working on it. Co-chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 786 requires the Bureau of Labor and Industries to increase investigatory staff dedicated to enforcing pay equity and gender discrimination law. The bill also appropriates $100,000 to general fund to BOLI to support the staffing increase. We should have a... If you've got a fiscal impact, I don't believe you do, as a fiscal light to get it down to Ways and Means. I believe the BOLI has identified about $159,000 general fund to fully fund the position.
All right, we have one person signed up, Mr. Knopp. Thanks for your patience.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Knope. I am legislative intern for Senator Tim Knope. Unfortunately, the senator was not able to attend the meeting today, so he sent me to testify for him on the bill. But he did want me to let you know that this legislation is important to him. Senate Bill 786, chief sponsored by Senator Knope, proposes that the Bureau of Labor Industries increases their efforts in enforcing pay equity laws. The bill will appropriate about $160,000 in order to add one full-time employment to the Bureau of Labor and Industries budget, which will be an enforcement position. The allocated funds will allow for it to be sustained throughout the biennium. As supporters of the bill, we recognize it is already illegal to discriminate based on gender, whether that be unequal pay for the same amount of work and the same efficiency, or firing an employee based on his or her gender. But while they are illegal, this bill would help to effectively enforce the laws that are in place and to allow the Bureau of Labor and Industries to investigate claims with more thorough efficiency. The bill was passed unanimously out of the Senate Committee on Workforce with a due recommendation to pass the bill. It's a very bipartisan bill, and we have not heard any opposition to the bill at this time. Pay equity in the workplace is important to the people of Oregon, and this will be making a step in the right direction to ensure that the current laws are being enforced. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knope. Any questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator.
In the bill itself, it mentions $100,000. I think you said $160,000. Do you know, has that been amended? Or I know it's the total cost.
If I can take a stab at that,
yes,
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, the bill itself has a $100,000 general fund appropriation to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. What staff was referencing earlier was the fact that when the Bureau of Labor and Industries submitted information to help form a full fiscal on that, which has not yet been issued, they gave us the price for a full-time position, which is slightly more than that. So that's the difference. There is no amendment that has been requested that I am aware of to this bill at this time.
Follow-up?
Please.
In the regular budget process, was any additional money allocated for enforcement?
Co-Chair Senator Hansel, BOLI's budget has not been to work session yet. However, there was not dollars in the agency request budget pertaining to additional enforcement. There were packages in the agency request budget that had to do with additional technical assistance to employers, and a package that had to do with an administrative support position for the ODOT Heavy Highway Fund for diversity.
Follow-up? If it wasn't important enough for Boley to put it in their budget request. I guess I'm having a little bit of a disconnect of how this works now. If they didn't request it, is the need? What evidence is there of a need then? I guess anybody. I'm open to any answer to that question.
Let me hold on that question for just a minute, if I could, Senator. And Senator Gelser, were you here on this measure as well?
I'm here on the bed.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I noticed that you were a co-sponsor of this bill. I just wanted to make sure we weren't missing you. Representative Nierman, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. So thanks for your presentation, Mr. Knopf. What evidence do you have that there's a problem of pay inequity in Oregon?
I cannot fully answer that question because I don't have all the information before me. At the moment, I would direct it to the Bureau of Labor Industries, but I did get a number from about 20% of the issues that they have received, requests to investigate, are about discrimination based on gender in the workplace. So there is a need for it in the work community, in the community of workers that need to be able to be represented fairly and to be investigated fairly.
Would it be possible to ask Ms. Sparks?
I was going to ask if Boley would like to comment on any of the questions that we've got in the last few minutes. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As you know, there's been a lot of discussion about equal pay over the past few years. The Oregon Council on Civil Rights did a report that was published in 2014, detailed how women in Oregon make 79 cents to the dollar for what a man makes, and that is an issue that gets even, the disparity gets even broader when we're talking about women of color who make in the low to mid 60 cents per hour for every dollar a man makes. So as part of these sort of ongoing discussions, I think Senator Knope saw an opportunity to focus resources in terms of adding a position to Boley to do enforcement. About it sort of ranges year to year, 20 to 30% of our cases are sex discrimination or pay inequity. It varies on the year.
And does, I'm sorry, a follow-up?
No, go ahead. I'll.
Thank you again. Does Bureau have a position on this bill?
Co-Chair Gomberg, we're supportive of the position of the bill. It wasn't, we make do with our limited resources, and did not seem the year to try and ask for more. But if there is strong feelings among the legislature that this is a good way to spend dollars, we will do everything we can to make sure that we use it to the best of our abilities.
Well answered. I'm just going to let Representative Nierman finish up. I think he had a follow-up.
I was going to ask, so you said there's some 30-ish percent of your complaints are pay inequity or gender discrimination. Could you roughly break that down within the 30%? Is that 50-50 or?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, it's hard to say because a lot of the gender discrimination cases will involve an element of equal pay. Equal pay under our current statutes, especially under civil rights, can't be enforced without being connected to a sex discrimination case, so they're never separate. I would say most of them are not. We don't have a lot of people filing complaints exclusively about an equal pay issue.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sparks, of that 20% filing, what percent is not being investigated at this time by your department in a timely manner?
Co-Chair Gohmer, Rep. Senator Hansel, I think that if with more resources, we could be a lot more timely. They're all being investigated, but the resolution can be a lengthy process.
What's a lengthy process?
It varies on the complexity of the case, but a complainant could be waiting quite for us to make it through all the way through a hearing process, could be a number of years.
A number of years, wow. And how would this position, what would this position, if you had it, I mean, does that affect that? I mean, if it's complex and stuff, does it, would that eliminate that?
Co-Chair Gohmert, Senator Hansel, I believe that it would make it so we could be a little bit more efficient. So, you know, the overall caseload for dealing with sex discrimination for each individual investigator could come down a bit in terms of just sheer caseload, and they could reach some resolutions a little bit quicker because they would be allocating their time better.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
How many caseworkers do you have handling this area right now or partially?
Co-Chair Gohmert, Senator Hansel, I don't have the exact numbers at my fingertips. I believe it's around 20.
Around 20. And of that 20, how many cases of this particular nature would each one potentially have, roughly speaking?
Bully, the Civil Rights Division gets about 38,000 inquiries a year. We conduct about 4,500 investigations a year, so those are spread out.
In this particular field or this particular category?
This particular category is currently the way we manage our caseload is dispersed amongst all investigators other than the ones that are solely dedicated to investigating, say, housing complaints.
Okay. Senator, did we get the answer to your first question about the agency original request and the supplemental measure?
I think Ms. Sparks asked. It wasn't something that we asked for. We didn't think it was appropriate, but we won't turn it down if it comes our way.
Basically what she said.
Co-Chair Gohmert, Senator Hansel.
I live all right.
That's, we certainly think it's valuable and important for us to have additional enforcement positions, but recognizing that the needs of the legislature, we didn't want to focus our energies on asking for more enforcement.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Are we going to have Bowley's budget in this subcommittee?
Yes, that is scheduled. Ms. Deister, do you recall when it has been rescheduled for?
I don't believe it has been posted yet, but I would say imminently. I would say if not by the end of this week, I would expect that you would see it next week.
Well, you know, Mr. Co-Chair, then that's probably the appropriate time to deal with this issue and to determine whether or not the additional funding is needed and appropriate and is a priority versus all the other needs that we're facing.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Witsit, you had a question?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry, I was late and maybe you covered this. Could you describe to me how Bowley is different than if a charge is made under or to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission regarding the, for example, pay inequity between a man and a woman? So can you tell me how the federal law is carried out versus Bowley? Or are they the same? Are the people who carry out the case work the same or what? How does that work?
Co-Chair Gohmert, Representative Witsit, Bowley has a contract with EEOC, so we do all the enforcement in Oregon. We investigate cases, there are timelines. Our laws are substantially similar, but we also apply federal law when we're looking at both a federal and state complaint.
Okay. follow up, if I may. How much money do you get from the EEOC, and are you under a memorandum of agreement or a memorandum of understanding with them, and are you reimbursed for the full amount when a case is filed?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Woodsett, I don't have that information with me right now, but I can certainly follow up with you.
Okay. Follow up. In particular, I'm interested in the reimbursement aspect of it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Representative Nierman, if I can hold it, I've got Senator Gelser who's got an appointment that she needs to get to, and I wonder if we could just hold that question, or is it a quick question?
No.
All right, why don't we hold off on that? And if you'll indulge me for a minute, I'm going to close temporarily the public hearing on 786, and I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 946. And Senator Gelser, I apologize for keeping you holding, but we got started late because the House was running until almost 4 o'clock.
Yes. Is it okay if Mr. Smith joins me?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, for your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis and Albany area, and I am very grateful to you for scheduling Senate Bill 946 today. This bill has had an interesting road that it has taken to, so I wanted to take a minute to tell you where it came from and why it is now in this form. About 2 years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., visiting with some folks on the Hill who were working on something that was called the Restore Honor Act. This has to do with individuals who have served in our military and under now outdated military policies were discharged from the military on the basis of their sexual orientation. Because of their sexual orientation, they were given a discharge status that was not honorable, and as a result were not for any wrongdoing, but because they happened to be gay or lesbian, and as a result were not eligible for federal and, in our state benefits that are available to veterans, everything from home loans to medical care. And in this conversation with this individual, we talked about what states could do, because sometimes it takes a while for Congress to get things done, and states on occasion can move a little bit more quickly. So I introduced a bill this session under another bill number that would have clarified that for state eligibility purposes in Oregon veterans who had been discharged solely because of their sexual orientation would be eligible for Oregon-based benefits for veterans. We had a hearing on that, and I had the opportunity to work with Cameron, who will talk a little bit more about the challenges of that approach. The primary one being it would take a lot of work to try to sort out who was solely discharged for that purpose and to find those individuals. That a much more efficient way of dealing with this would be to create an outreach coordinator, an LGBT, lesbian, gay, and bisexual, transgendered outreach coordinator that could find these individuals, find out the needs that they had, and then assist them to appeal their discharge status and upgrade their discharge credentials, which could potentially then make them eligible not just for their state level benefits, but also for their federal level benefits. One of the things that really surprised me as I worked on this, I had originally assumed that this had to do with individuals that were discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that we would be looking at vets that were primarily my age and a little bit younger. In fact, the population that this bill will primarily impact are World War II and Korean War veterans. If you can imagine for a moment a veteran of that generation being discharged on the basis of sexual orientation, the shame and the humiliation that would come with that, and how difficult it would be to reach out to the military community for assistance and help, especially as these individuals are now in their older years and probably in the most need of help. I was surprised at our second hearing on this in the Senate Veterans Committee that we had a World War II veteran come and talk about how important this bill was and what an important message it was to recognize the service of these individuals. We had made an error in our national policy as it related to the service and the integrity of these people, and this is a way in Oregon that we can step up and do something about it. The other thing that surprised me in our initial hearing on the first bill, there was a representative here from the U.S. Department of Defense. They, too, were following this bill and looking at it potentially as a national model legislation to share with states for next year. So I think we have a very unique opportunity here to really reach out to a population in need of services and really help them access services that they have earned through their sacrifice to our country, through their bravery, and through no fault of their own. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Cameron can talk more about the specifics of exactly how this will work and why this is the best approach to move forward.
Thank you, Senator. And I know that you've got some time commitments, so I just wanted to ask a question or two. I noticed one of the sections of the legislation talked about reporting back to the Legislative Assembly in September of 2015, and I sense that there's some challenges in starting up this program and locating the appropriate target population. That seems like a long time to wait to hear back. Did you help us understand the logic there?
So, Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, just to clarify, I think it's 2018. I don't think they can be ready by this fall.
I apologize. I was reading over to the second page, and 15 jumped out at me. But yes, you're correct. I apologize.
I think by the time we are able to get this, goes into effect, is posted, you recruit the person, they're able to go out and get the information and really do a good needs assessment, any change in policy might take them that long. There's nothing that would prevent the agency from coming back earlier with a report, and I would be certainly open to moving that date up. I'm sure that Mr. Smith may have other things to say about that.
Other questions for Senator Gelser?
And if, with your permission, because we pushed that back to 4:15, may I stay and listen?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and want to thank Senator Gelser for bringing the original bill forward and then also working closely with us and the stakeholder community, and here to testify on behalf and in favor of Senate Bill 946. Where I start out, a veteran is a veteran. You know, whether you're when I was in the Marines, whether you were black, brown, white, everyone was true green Marine, and there is that culture across our military and our veterans community. But we also have some very specific underserved groups of veterans across our landscape that I would add in: women veterans, rural veterans, even our Vietnam veterans that weren't welcomed home in their own time. And most definitely our LGBT veterans are among those groups of underserved veterans. And for all of our veterans, when they raise their right hand to defend us and protect our rights, it is our commitment, both as a state and a nation, to have their back when they come home. All of us gain great strength from our service, but no doubt that we face challenges from our service. And I think when you hear some of the testimony today from our LGBT veterans, almost a double whammy of challenges that you can face in a culture in the military that wasn't always truly inclusive of our LGBT service members. That grew out of the official policy of the military and DOD, Department of Defense, in terms of LGBT being incompatible with military service, and often resulted in a discharge characterization that then makes them ineligible for state benefits. We have under honorable conditions. There are similar eligibility criteria at the federal VA level. There is a process through the different branches of the military to upgrade that paperwork. It would be one push, but also looking at simply a big piece of this is just the coordination, the outreach for a population of veterans that doesn't have a lot of trust in the veteran services landscape to build those bridges and to build that relationship, to build back that trust and share the information of the benefits that are available. Just want to clarify also, in terms of the role, you know, the county veteran service officers are those boots on the ground submitting direct claims, but this is a sweet spot in terms of calling out at a high level, whether it's for homeless veterans, whether it's for women veterans, that will have another concept come before this committee. To have that expertise on the LGBT veterans coordinator at the state level, we'll be able to filter that down to the 36 county and the other veteran service officers to truly make sure that we're stepping up for what is an underserved veterans population. And happy to take any questions.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, I think that last point is key. That's the reason why you have the dash one amendment.
Very good. Any questions? Representative Whitson.
If you'll bear with me, since I'm not familiar with dishonorable discharges, So when you're determining qualification for this bill under dishonorable discharge, will the bill consider dishonorable behavior while on duty or on sexual orientation alone for the dishonorable discharge designation?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, the original concept would have created some structures within our statute that changed what we accept as character of discharge. In terms of looking for upgrades of their military discharge, it would still go back into the Department of Defense for final determination, but it would be for that character of discharge. The ideal scenario is when it's solely because of their sexual orientation. That's the ones that are going to have the most legs in terms of advocating for, even for when there's federal VA waivers. It can't have aggravating circumstances that are other issues across the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I may, the intention here really is around that issue of the sole reason for that separation being sexual orientation, not
behavior.
Correct.
Okay, and if I may follow up, in lines like 15 through 21 of the bill, it mentions spouses and dependents of such veterans. So would the children of the partner be considered for benefits?
So Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, right now there are still some challenges in terms of federal VA policies, even after the Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the no longer enforcement on the DOMA Act. But eventually it will be seamless, just like heterosexual partners and their dependents, whether it's for burial in national cemeteries or whether it's for other survivor benefits at that federal level.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, the bill itself does not make any changes to eligibility for benefits. What this coordinator would do is provide assistance with going through the application process. Whether or not those children were eligible for benefits would be dependent on the rules and eligibility criteria that are set elsewhere. This bill does nothing to change the eligibility criteria themselves.
Any follow-up?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying there, but so would the dependents have to have been, the children of the partner have to have been the children of the partner and the partner have been when the person was in the service? Or is it, can they take on a new family now and have those dependents be eligible for these benefits?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, it would mirror, I think, what we found for all veterans, and I believe, I'd have to double check in terms of the federal VA rules and regulations, if they are legally your dependent, that would become, I believe it's just the legal definition of whether they are your dependent or not, whether it was a later joining of your family or not. So if I adopted someone today, they would become my dependent. And if I was eligible for federal VA benefits for that individual, it would become,
okay,
it would be seamless for a heterosexual or a...
That's what I was wondering. If adoption would be the way that the dependents would become eligible for the benefits, through adoption only or through...
I think it's simply if they are your dependent, whether it was a, your own child or adopted.
Right. I get your own child or adopted, but since some, well, I'm just trying to understand exactly who all can come into the system under this new definition of partner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hildreth Whitsitt, I think I did a poor job before in trying to answer the question. So if... Let's say I wanted to apply to play on a kickball team, and the eligibility criteria for serving on that kickball team was that I had a red ball and I had played kickball for a year on another team. And then we created a coordinator that helped me fill out the application to participate on that kickball team. Nothing about that coordinator would change the rules about the ball that I had to have and the experience I had to have before. They would just help me fill out the application. So this bill is just about helping people access the rules as they exist. There's nothing in this bill that would change any dependent's eligibility for any services or benefits. This is just about helping people apply for benefits for which they are already eligible. Does that make sense?
Kind of, but if you'll indulge me, I'm still trying to understand the military. So if a, say in a heterosexual relationship, a man and a woman live together and she has four children and he's in the military, they live together but they're not married and he hasn't adopted those children, are his are her children eligible dependents in the military right now?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, it really would come down to just that state's legal definition of dependent. I don't know in that specific case.
In Oregon, because there's probably a lot of military that are living with people. So if they aren't married to them, are they considered dependents? And is that partner who's not married? In the military right now, I'm just talking about right now because that's what you're addressing. It's not going to change anything from now. So I'm asking, under the law right now, if a man in the military lives with a woman with, say, five kids, is she and are her dependents, her children, considered eligible for military dependents without being married in Oregon right now?
Co-Chair Gomberg, I don't know the answer to that question. All
right. Mr. Smith, maybe we can get you to follow up with Representative Whitsitt offline and dig in a little deeper on the questions that she had here. But as I understand, the core answer to your question is that the benefits don't change. We're just looking at a new population group that that could avail themselves of the benefits that are in place.
And Mr. Chair, I would put, I'm just kind of thinking through other places where you claim your dependents. I think that question would be, are they claiming those kids as a dependent on their tax return? Are they required to contribute to the support of those individuals? Are they required to carry them on their health insurance? There are a lot of other factors out there that create that difference between. There are cases where people live together and they are not married, and just because everybody lives in the household doesn't make them a legal dependent.
Right. So what, follow up, I'm just trying to establish what the law is right now so we can see what we are going to add to it. So I just, it's a simple question. I just need an answer to, are domestic partnerships outside of marriage within the military in Oregon right now recognized as that partner and their children as dependents of the person employed.
Mr. Smith, I'm going to invite you to follow up with Representative Whitsitt,
yeah, thank
if that's
you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman, did you have a question?
Yeah, for kid, please. So what kind of, Mr. Smith, what kind of numbers do you think we're talking about here?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, I think it's a difficult answer or difficult question to answer. It is a very quiet population. I would estimate probably about 4 to 5% of our veterans population, but it's a somewhat of a stab in the dark.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for
yes.
this panel?
Yes,
Senator.
4 or 5% would translate into what?
Representative or Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator. We have 320,000 veterans across the state. 10% would be about 34,000, so about 15,000.
Okay. Follow up?
Yeah, a couple follow ups, if I may just follow directly. I guess my question is I'm assuming you're not doing anything now to reach out to these folks. If not, why not?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, one of the interesting dynamics in for our headquarters here, where we have statewide veteran service officers, currently Marion and Polk do not have a county veteran service officer compared to the other 34 counties that do. So often our work gets focused on boots on the ground claims, specifically for veterans that are within striking distance of our headquarters. Over time, we would hope to stand up Marion County and Polk County with that local veteran service office function so that we could take our statewide veteran service officers to truly be that value added back to the counties on specific populations and policy areas. That has been one of the historic focuses that we've been trying to shift forward.
So what you're saying is that you would take the funding for this position, make them a Polk and Marion County
deal?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, we would still have our veteran service officers serving the local community, but this would be a separate appropriation above and beyond what we have today to be specifically focused on outreach to this community.
But community of veterans. Would they be doing county?
Statewide.
But would they be doing in addition to county?
No.
So you're not combining the positions that you've just talked about?
Correct.
Why wasn't this a part of the original budget?
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, in our 20% ask that embedded in the governor's budget works out to be about $2.5 million. About half of that we've built to going down to the county level. Some of our other policy position or some of our other policy packages, high level on IT asks, on policy analyst positions, and simply in terms of how we work forward on our prioritization.
So it wasn't a priority then to ask for it initially?
It was not included in the governor's budget originally.
What is the fiscal on this?
I believe we have a little under 200,000. It would be a policy analyst 3 position, which I believe works out to be about 155,000 on the personnel costs, and then about, I want to say, 30,000 on the SNS.
Fiscal impact statement that's been issued totals $197,739 general fund and 1.00 FTE, depending upon how long it would take to recruit and hire that position, you might shave a little bit off in terms of the months, depending on when this got underway.
Other questions? Thank you so much, and thank you for your patience, Senator.
Thank you very much.
We have 2 other people signed up on this for this hearing. Is it Ms. Curry and Jenna?
Gina,
excuse me. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Just introduce yourself for the record, and we'd be happy to hear from you.
Senator Gomberg, representatives. My name is Casey Curry. I'm currently the Outreach Coordinator for Returning Veterans Project. I am a 26-year combat veteran of the Oregon Army National Guard, and I served closeted. You want to introduce, or want to go ahead?
Please, go ahead.
So in 26 years of service, being a gay service member created a lot of mental stress. Not only while in uniform, but while not in uniform. If I want to go out in public, I have to cover my face, because if command or other people found out, I could have been dishonorably discharged. I did serve with honor. I was honorably discharged. I'm proud of that service. And there are many people in this state who served and did not get to complete their service because of discharge. There were 13,000 veterans discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And there were many more veterans discharged prior to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And those numbers I do not have. As far as their discharges, pre-1970s, they were mostly given general discharges if they had not committed a homosexual act. But if they had, then they were given an undesirable discharge, which makes these people not qualify for any benefits. So they don't get VA benefits. They can't seek health care. They can't apply for home loan. They can't get education. And yet these people have served with honor and distinction, and for the most part were solely discharged for strictly their sexual orientation. I've been doing veteran services now for about 7 years, from education to my current position. My current position is we provide free mental health and somatic services to post 9/11 war zone veterans and their families throughout the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. And with that, we have in the last year gotten many providers who now serve the LGBTQA community and have gotten a small feedback, because it's 100% confidential. We don't ever know who the clients are, but we do sometimes, they do call and let us know that thanking us for providing this service. And some of them have now been able to get some help that they have needed. I truly support this position. I supported 961, the first bill, and I do support this one. It is a small community that deserves to be seen and deserves to say I was a veteran and to be able to do that with honor and pride. So I just want to let you know that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your work, and in particular, thank you for your service.
My pleasure.
Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, my name is Gina Frazzini. I'm the co-executive director of Basic Rights Oregon. We're a statewide advocacy organization working to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians truly experience equality. We were thrilled to support the call to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2010. The policy was discriminatory and shameful, and we're so glad to see it abolished. We're grateful for the United States Open Service Policy that allows individuals to serve regardless of who they love, with less fear for being targeted, and to serve with honor. However, Oregon still has many veterans that are unable to access benefits to which they would otherwise be entitled because they were dismissed from the military under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy or before because of their sexual orientation. While some of these folks were dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, others stretch back all the way to World War II under pre-existing policies. When these dismissals, which are classified, as Ms. Curry talked about, as dishonorable or other than honorable, it excludes individuals from state and federal benefits. And we believe that Oregon should start to address this precisely as this bill conceives, creating a position that can support veterans in navigating a very cumbersome and challenging process to apply to change their status or to access benefits they might believe that they're excluded from. There's a long legacy of fear and distrust and misinformation that remains in the wake of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and previous policies. So SB 946 would create the needed position called the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Coordinator within the Department of Veterans Affairs. And we see this as an opportunity for LGBT veterans who were discharged because of their sexual orientation to get that their discharge status upgraded. Many don't know that they have this option, and an LGBT coordinator could help them. It would serve the needed role of conducting outreach specific to this community, education, and assistance in navigating a process where expertise and specific knowledge and time is dearly valued and dearly needed. So we're glad that Senator Gelser was able to work with the Veterans Administration to draft this position to ensure they have the resources to provide outreach to our community. This bill gives Oregon a chance once again to lead the country in honoring the work and sacrifice of all veterans. So I ask you to please pass Senate Bill 946 so that all our veterans can access the benefits and services available to all of Oregon's service members. At Basic Rights Oregon, we believe that all LGBT veterans should get the recognition and equal treatment they deserve, and we urge your passage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Senator.
Ms. Curry, I'm not familiar with so much on the military. Maybe I should have asked Mr. Smith when he's up here, but let me ask you this question. If I have a document of someone who was dishonorably discharged, is there a way that it is identified as to why they were dishonorably discharged, particularly if you were a gay person? Does it show that some way? Is there? I'm just not familiar with that. How would you know?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, yes. On the DD-214, which is the military discharge document, under the character of services, there have been DD-214s that said due to homosexuality.
Okay.
And that it's been left at that. Those, you know, I'm assuming were solely because of sexual orientation. Others were not explicit as far as why. We run into this a lot with females who are military sexual assault survivors, where, let me talk to you about my own experience. When I went to school right after entering the military in 1981, I had a senior enlisted sergeant who his goal was to sleep with all the females because in his eyes all females were gay and he was going to turn them and when that did not happen, we were set up and given, it's called an Article 15 I had reduced in pay, was restricted to the barracks in the post for 2 weeks, but it was because supposedly I'd come in late one night. So, you know, even though I wasn't discharged, the Article 15 states something totally different, and there have been cases where your DD 214 is not explicit in that. That is something where testimony from service members that you served from, people that you know, they could help. They would be able to help get documentation as far as sending that in to get that changed. But there are some that do specifically say.
Follow-up?
Two quick follow-ups. Answer the same. If you're discharged, you would have your discharge papers available to you, or you can get them mostly?
Yes. Then you can go to the, any service member can go to the National Archives and order medical records, service records, and a copy of your DD 214. Okay. Now, I will have to say that in 1976, there was a fire, and the National Records Center was destroyed. They have been able to recreate some of those DD 214s. A service member who has served with pride and got to leave honorably kept it. If you not did not so much, a lot of times they didn't keep them. But yes, you can order them and get them.
But if something like this is happening in Oregon, that would be a proof of what they would need to come forward with, I would think.
Correct. If they served on active duty, they'll receive a DD 214. If they served in the National Guard of any state, they receive what is called an NGB 22, which kind of gives the exact same information as a DD 214.
My second question, really quickly, you mentioned it earlier. Would it be more often than not that if you were discharged for homosexual activity, they would add other things to it as well, as far as behavior is concerned, and how are you going to know if that's legit or not?
Early on, yes, there were people who were discharged, and the status on the discharge paper was false. And like I said, it's if a person has stayed in touch with people, or if they specifically have maybe papers for whatever reason, let's say somebody was discharged for being homosexual, but on their discharge paper it said it was under a code of conduct, there would be a paper trail, because you have to be brought up on charges and people have to do write-ups, and if that paper trail can't be found, then, you know, I'm only assuming, because it is at the federal level that changes that. If there was no documentation to back up what that DD 214 was saying, then they would possibly upgrade that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative.
So help me again, because I'm new to all this. Could you discuss, I've heard the term undesirable discharge, a dishonorable discharge, and other than honorable discharge. And I was wondering if you could explain, would all of these fall under this bill, or how are they different?
So, depending on the character of your character of service, why you are being discharged. So, for example, it could be a code of military justice thing. It could be the fact that you did something you weren't supposed to. You committed adultery. You committed murder. You told your commanding officer off. You use language that they didn't like. It's really broad, and you can actually Google discharge statuses, and it will give you the breakdown of each individual. There's about 9 different discharge statuses, and you can Google, and they kind of go into more specifics.
Okay, so the follow-up was, would this bill fall, would all 9 fall? Encompass in this bill?
So here's the thing with this bill, is this bill does not have the right to change any discharge status on a DD 214 or a discharge paper. This bill is only to help the service member navigate through the system in order to apply for an upgrade of that document. Those documents are done at the federal level, and that has to go through a process. So, for example, let's say a Vietnam-era veteran, and we know that a lot of things happened that should not have happened, told his commander off, he got dishonorably discharged, and now wants to now try to seek benefits. It really didn't happen, so there's a process they go through, and they use the VSOs, the Veterans Service Officers, or American Legion, or BFW, wherever they live in that state. And there's documents, and they have forms that they would fill out, and they send that forward up to the East Coast, to the federal level, and then they investigate that, and they determine whether or not that discharge status will be upgraded or changed or waived or whatever the case may be. So for this position, this position would just navigate, help that person navigate through a very complicated system, and to help maybe get any backup that they might have to change or to upgrade their status in order to receive benefits.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. Yes, Representative.
Thanks. So I'm trying to get my arms around the numbers. First of all, Ms. Curry, thanks for your service, and thanks also for the extra burden that you were put under by being in the closet the whole time. I appreciate your courage doing that. But I'm trying to get my arms around the numbers here, what the potential numbers are. So you said it's a small community of people there, and I know nobody's got the right answer, but just what do you think on the numbers there?
So as Director Smith said, there are over 300,000 veterans as a whole throughout the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon is very small. We are one of six states that does not have an active duty post. So 5% of that is about 15,000. So compared to the 300,000, that's a small number. But 15,000, that's 15,000 veterans that have possibly have never been able to utilize any of their benefits. And to be able to help somebody, to have somebody to help them navigate through a difficult system, like trying to get in through the federal VA system or through the DOD for a change, can be really overwhelming. It's the same thing as when we're applying for a VA disability. It is crazy on what you have to go through to do that. So to have somebody there that can help you and guide you and make you understand why certain documents come about or why they're needed, then that makes that a little easier. So 15,000, that's a lot of people. And a lot of people that potentially have not ever received benefits. So, but because there's really never been any hardcore outreach to the LGBT community to have exact numbers, that's going to take a little while.
So if I can follow. So the number 5%, though, where are you getting that number? Are you saying that's the your estimated number of people just in the community at large, in the world at large, that are LGBT?
Best guess.
Okay.
Best guess, just based on you know the percentage of veterans that we have in the state. So there's over 300,000 veterans in the state. There's over 228,000 war veterans. There's 58,000 post-9/11 war zone veterans and 38,000 Afghanistan-Iraq veterans. So just with that population, and because it's, you know, and I don't know, just the best guess number that it could be higher. It could be as high as 10 to 15%. 5% is maybe just a guess. Try to make some kind of an educated guess.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you again so much. Welcome. Is there anybody else here that wants to testify on 946? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 946. I'm going to return to the public hearing on 786. We may have been at a closing stage there, but we interrupted things because we wanted to provide a little courtesy to a member who was conflicted time-wise, and I apologize that in return for that we disadvantaged you two. But where were we when we left off? I think Representative Nierman had some questions.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Sparks, thanks for hanging around in this. So this is for pay equity and gender discrimination. What kinds of gender discrimination do you get complaints about, other than the pay equity thing? I think I understand that.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman. Gender discrimination covers a number of things. It could be sexual harassment, pregnancy discrimination, so a woman wasn't hired because she was pregnant, or simply your basic discrimination where a qualified woman applied for a job and she was passed over for, I mean, the discrimination complaint would largely be she was passed over for a less qualified man. Those are sort of run the gamut of gender discrimination, the sort of typical cases that you'd see. So in employment, yeah.
A follow-up?
Men are many more times likely than women to die or be injured on the job. Would you consider that to be a form of a equity problem or a gender discrimination problem?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman, I'm not sure how to, because they're just more likely to die on the job.
Right.
I don't know how to answer that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you both. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on 786? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And Ms. Dykstra, do you have anything else for us today?
Not today, sir. These were the only two items that have been posted. And I believe that we are at 24-hour notice these days. So please keep your eyes open.
All right. Well, I thank you, everybody. I apologize for jumping around a little bit for a couple of reasons and getting a late start. But I'm going to go ahead and adjourn this meeting.
No. No.